From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bobby Short, America's foremost cabaret singer, is celebrating his 30th year at the Café Carlyle in New York. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with Bobby Short. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is paying tribute to screenwriter Frances Marion and the powerful women of early Hollywood. We'll hear from Marion's biographer, Carrie Beecham. Ian Whitcomb tells us about his research, showing that the final song performed on the Titanic was not "Nearer, My God, to Thee." We'll hear his performance of the song he says was the final one. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two country music CDs that stand out for what they lack, the big star sound of today's country music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton and British Prime Minister Tony Blair say both their countries stand together in policy on Iraq. They held a news conference at the White House a short time ago where they discussed the standoff between Iraq and the United Nations. Prime Minister Blair says he hopes for a diplomatic solution, but he says other options must remain open.
We have, of course, to prepare in case diplomacy cannot work. In view of the situation, we in Britain have been looking at our own military readiness in case a diplomatic solution does not in the end prove possible. We have decided to base 8 Tornado GR1 aircraft in Kuwait with the full agreement of the government of Kuwait. These are ground attack and reconnaissance aircraft. Their deployment is a precautionary measure and it will take place over the next few days.
During the news conference, President Clinton was asked again about allegations that he had an intimate relationship with former intern Monica Lewinsky and asked her to lie about it under oath. Mr. Clinton also responded to a news report that his secretary, Betty Curry, discussed testimony with the president in his office.
The rain has created raging rivers out of secondary streams, and hillsides are now waterfalls. Thousands of people have packed up.
Let me first of all say, once again, I never ask anybody to do anything but tell the truth. I know about the stories today. I was pleased that Ms. Curry's lawyers stated unambiguously this morning, that she's not aware of any unethical conduct. But this investigation is going on, and you know what the rules for it are. And I just think as long as it's going on, I should not comment on the specific questions.
Meanwhile, more American warplanes are headed for the Persian Gulf region. Defense Secretary William Cohen says he'll formally approve the deployment in the next day or two. A new Pacific storm is lashing Northern California. Flooding has forced thousands to flee. Ansel Martinez of member station KQED reports from the Russian River Valley.
The rain has created raging rivers out of secondary streams, and hillsides are now waterfalls. Thousands of people have packed up their belongings and moved to higher ground. Water covers vineyards, pasture land, roads, and neighborhoods in this region just north of San Francisco. Despite the warnings, other people won't budge from their homes. Emergency official Harry Martin says safety crews don't want to resort to boat or helicopter rescues.
For people to get out on their own early before the flood rises is far more safe and efficient for everybody concerned.
Another El Nino storm is lurking over the Pacific, so conditions could deteriorate further. For NPR News, I'm Ansel Martinez in the Russian River Valley.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 89 points at 8,206. Trading's active. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is rallying on optimism about stable interest rates. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports. Yale University says that some 42% of the school's undergraduates received need-based financial aid last year to attend school. That number could increase this year. Yale has just announced attending the undergraduate college will cost almost $31,000 beginning in the autumn semester. The school's president says that the 2.9% increase to $30,830 is the lowest percentage increase in 30 years. The new fee includes $23,780 for tuition and $7,050 for room and board. Yale College, which is the undergraduate school of the university, has an enrollment of 5,200 students. The nation's biggest bank may eliminate more than 3,000 administrative jobs this year. The Wall Street Journal says Chase Manhattan is in the midst of a restructuring in an effort to reduce expenses. Donald Trump reportedly has hired a pair of investment banks to help him sell all or part of his Trump hotels and casino reports. The Wall Street Journal says that Trump is hoping to cash in on recent high-priced casino sales, this despite a depressed price for his company's stock. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 89 points at 8,206 in active trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index is up 4.5 points at 1681. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America's foremost cabaret singer, Bobby Short, has a new CD celebrating his 30th anniversary at the elegant New York night spot, the Café Carlyle. On today's archive edition, we have an interview we recorded back in 1985 after the publication of his memoir. Short's vast repertoire covers the history of American popular song, from early Kern in Berlin to Sondheim. His performances and records have kept alive Porter and Gershwin favorites and have revived many of their forgotten gems. Let's start with a song from one of Bobby Short's early albums, recorded in the late 1950s. The song is Fun to be Fooled, with music by Harold Arlen and a lyric by Ira Gershwin and Yip Harburg.
Spring is here. I'm a fool if I fall again, and yet I'm intrigued by love's call again. You say you love me, I know from the past. You mean to love me, but these things don't last. Fools rush in to begin new love affairs. But tonight, tonight, my dear, who cares? Fun to be fooled. Fun to pretend. Fun to believe love is unending. Thought I was done. Still, it is fun to be fooled again. Nice when you tell all that you feel. Nice to be told this is the real thing. Fun to be kissed. Fun to exist. To be fooled again. It's that old devil moon having his fling once more, selling me spring once more. I'm afraid love is king once more. Fun to be fooled. Fun to pretend. This little dream won't end. It's that old once more. Fun to be fooled. Fun to pretend. This little dream won't end.
Bobby Short singing and accompanying himself at the piano. Short represents sophistication, but he's not a native of the high society that embraced him. He grew up in Danville, Illinois, where his mother was active in the church and made a living as a domestic. Short played roadhouses and the vaudeville circuit before reaching puberty. Bobby Short told me that when he was a child, jazz was frowned on by the church, but he listened anyway.
If your mother was kind of strict about what kind of music you went to hear, how did you end up playing in roadhouses and saloons when you were nine?
Well, you have to remember that back in those days, there was a deep, deep depression spread over America, and money was awfully hard to come by. And the fact that I could earn money made a lot of things different.
What kind of material were you playing when you were a child?
Jazz. Oh, pure jazz. We played all the popular songs in the saloons. People danced. And then when I was 12, I left Danville and I became involved in honest-to-goodness vaudeville.
And what were you doing there?
I was playing the piano and singing then, but I was in a white tail suit, you see, on the stage, and I performed with great dignity. And I was a child performer.
Did you have to learn to tap dance and things like that?
Oh, no. I think every other colored kid in America, I say color because that was the word they used in those days, on the stage tap danced. I could never learn the tap dance very well. And I played the piano and sang. I was given lessons constantly. I could not learn to dance. And I played and sang, though, and I had my white tail suit. I performed on vaudeville stages around the Midwest and part of the East.
Were you singing songs with sophisticated and world-weary lyrics when you were 12?
Well, it was difficult in those days to find songs that were exactly suitable for a 12-year-old. There were a couple of kids around in those days performing, and so whenever big star kids, I mean like Judy Garland and Bobby Breen and Deanna Durbin and Harold Nicholas, and whenever they sang a song, I think, well, this is appropriate for me to sing. But it was not easy to find songs for a kid to sing. Of course, I preferred to sing about smoking and drinking and never thinking of tomorrow.
What did it mean to you, though?
Oh, it just meant sophistication, I suppose, and grown up, which, of course, I was not. But my mind was very receptive to sophisticated music. And so, of course, it didn't matter to me about the lyrics. I just thought they were something that went along with the music.
Had you taken piano lessons?
Not really. I'm self-taught. Mainly. And at one point during my very early years at the piano, my mother thought that I should take lessons. Because in those days, every household had a piano, and always somebody in the household played the piano. And my mother played the piano tiny bit. All the renders, that's my mother's family, were musical to some degree.
Well, you have extraordinary enunciation. Do you credit any of that to your vocal coach?
My vocal coach, and I think my good ear, and really whiz-bang high school education in Danville, Illinois.
Are there any, like, secrets to enunciating without doing anything that really exaggerates the language too much?
I think there are tricks, and those tricks are some of the things that I learned from my old music teacher in Illinois at Danville High School. I think there are ways to go about pronouncing certain sounds, certain vowel sounds, that make it that make the sounds less offensive, because sometimes an owl sound can sound terrible. You don't want to let you say you learn to say now instead of now, and you learn to grab onto those consonants as quickly as you possibly can, and there are ways.
You were telling us a couple of minutes ago that you took voice lessons, but you're self-taught at the piano. Do you know how to read music? Did you teach yourself
how to
do that?
Not really very well at all. And I have such respect now for the music that I play that I don't rely upon myself at all to take a song and learn it cold. If I'm really in difficulty, I'll call in a pianist to teach me the song.
And they'll sit down and...
Sit down and show me the proper chords, and I have this indestructible memory which has helped me all these years.
I figure you must, because you're, hundreds and hundreds of songs.
Yes.
Do you ever blank out on the words?
I have a few times, but most of the time, I have a computer inside somewhere. If I just press the right combination of numbers, it all comes rolling right out again after years and years and years of neglect.
When did you start actually developing the repertoire that you're famous for now of popular song standards, Rodgers and Hart, Cole Porter, the Gershwins, Irving Berlin?
I began that as soon as I knew about it. I heard a funny story about a young lady from Mississippi who had moved to New York, and somebody said, "When did you first go to New York?" She said, "As soon as I heard about it." And as soon as I heard about Rodgers and Hart, I didn't know a thing about Rodgers and Hart in Danville, Illinois. A Cole Porter was the name we all knew about, but we didn't know about Rodgers and Hart. We didn't know about Arthur Schwartz and Howard Dietz. We knew about George Gershwin, of course, and Rhapsody in Blue and Porgy and Bess. But the people who were the mainstays on the Broadway musical stage were unknown to us in a small town like Danville. But as soon as I left Danville, I learned about those things, and it became an all-consuming interest with me, and I set about learning all I could possibly learn.
Could you tell what attracted you to those songs, why you knew that was it and not Boogie Woogie and not the blues?
I don't know. I felt that I was better equipped to... I've always had a great fondness for the language, and I had 4 years of English in high school, which should tell you something. And I've always been attracted to words and the putting together of phrases and sentences. And I used to write poetry when I was a child. And I felt that to sing these songs was not going to wear me out and bore me. And so I learned them. It wasn't easy because my agents at the time would have had a much easier time promoting a young black boy who played Boogie Woogie and sang than a young black boy who was singing the latest hits from some obscure Cole Porter show on Broadway. But I'd learned the rudiments of performing when I was a child, and so I was always entertaining the people, and it didn't much matter with what I was entertaining them, so long as I entertained them.
You have been at the Cafe Carlyle since 1968.
Yes.
Can you tell us the story of how you first became the pianist and singer there?
Oh, it's not a big story. It's just that I was called in when the new owner, Peter Sharp, owned the hotel. He called me in one day to take the place of his vacationing pianist who'd been there for a long time. And I was a great success in the room. And so, of course, they asked me if I'd come back and play an engagement there. And, of course, I wanted to because I'd always wanted to work at the Cafe Carlyle. And with that, I believe they offered their steady pianist half the year and me the other half of the year. And he did not like that arrangement at all. And so they gave the whole year to me, which I quickly altered to suit my own capacities.
We're featuring a 1985 interview with Bobby Short, who is now celebrating his 30th anniversary at the Cafe Carlyle in New York. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to our interview with Bobby Short, let's hear him do a song from one of the composers he's most associated with, Cole Porter. This is Short's 1957 recording of Dream Dancing.
When day is gone and night comes on, until the dawn, what do I do? I touch your hand and wander through slumberland, dream dancing with you. We glide between a sky serene and fields of green, sparkling with dew. It's joy sublime whenever I spend my time dream dancing with you. Dream
dancing. Oh, what a lucky windfall, touching you, clutching you all the night through. So say you love me, dear, and let me make my career dream dancing to paradise prancing. Dream dancing with you. Dream dancing. Oh, what a lucky windfall, touching you, clutching you all the night through. So say you. Let me make my career dream dancing to paradise prancing. Dream dancing with you.
What do you see your role as being in American popular music?
Oh, I don't know. I am so shy about trying to put a label on myself. I just think that I play and sing what I like, and I don't attach any long-term importance to it. It's given me pleasure. It's earned me a comfortable living, and it's entertained a lot of people, I suppose, over the years. But I don't look upon myself as some kind of prophet or paragon of invention or whatever, you know. I'm kind of a keeper of the flame, I suppose.
Well, one of the things you've done for me as a listener is introduce me to songs that I fear I wouldn't otherwise have found out about. And then, you know, kept songs alive that I've really enjoyed, too. How do you find the songs that are the lesser-known gems that you perform?
Well, I have a rather good ear for things like that. And then, of course, if it gets around that you're into songs like that, people who have access to them are all too willing to bring them to you. Many of the songs that I learned in the 1940s were brought to me by people who had heard them in shows or who loved them and hadn't heard them since they'd seen the show. I was lucky enough to meet people who had written some of those songs, and, of course, they brought their songs to me, people like Burton Lane and Cole Porter.
What did Cole Porter bring to you?
Oh, goodness, I can't even think. But he certainly gave me lots of extra lyrics to things.
Did you ever perform when Cole Porter was in the room?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Many times.
Did he have a way that he liked his songs interpreted?
Well, I never found him fidgety about his songs being interpreted by performers. I never found him demanding or too critical. Many composers are. But this was a very level-headed, I believe, very democratic man, Cole Porter. And I think that he was always aware of the fact that he came from Peru, Indiana. I think more and more that he was aware of that. And from a little society, a very socially ambitious mother. But he was not a part automatically of the society that he sought or that took him up. And I think he remembered all of those humble beginnings. I don't mean humble in terms of poverty, because he was not poor ever. But let's face it, coming from the Midwest and going off to crash into Eastern society back in those days just wasn't being done very often.
It's funny because his songs really define that kind of society, and
he wasn't even
from it.
And so that is another thing that I've thought about a lot. I think that not being part of it gave him a chance to be objective about it more than he could have been had he been part of the society.
Isn't that true of you in a way, too? Because you were an outsider to New York.
Absolutely.
High society.
Absolutely.
And now you've become a symbol of it.
Well, not really. Not ever really a part of it. But I think that I share that with Cole Porter a great deal.
Have your friends or fellow performers ever urged you to get with it and sing the now songs, sing the songs of today?
Well, I went through a very, very bleak period in the 1960s when Beatlesitis took over the universe. And it was very tough going for a while. And it was amazing how many people came to me and said, look, if you want me to finance you, I'll finance you. You can buy yourself an act. That was the act. That was the idea. Then you bought an act. You got a choreographer and you got an act. Learned some new songs and went out to Las Vegas, I suppose, and earned zillions of dollars a week. I was asked to record this and record that and to change my style and to change other things about myself, the way I dressed, the way I looked, the way I presented myself. And it was very interesting, but I held on and stuck to my guns and managed to survive.
Were you, was it suggested that you start wearing jumpsuits? And
well, costumes, you know, just something smart from Saint Laurent. Something in velvet or, you know, a coverall in silk or whatever, just something far out.
But you don't expect to ever change either your repertoire or your
I don't think so.
Style of singing
I don't
because
think
of trends?
So. There's danger in that at this point. I think that what it is that I've become is a fairly solidly founded thing, and it's certainly regarded by people who support me as something solid. And to move out of that into something else would be a shock, not only to my supporters and my fans, but also to my own sense of integrity.
Bobby Short, recorded in 1985. His new CD is called Bobby Short and His Orchestra, celebrating 30 years at the Cafe Carlyle. Let's hear a song from it. This is Picture Me Without You, which was performed in the 1936 Shirley Temple film Dimples. The song is by Ted Kohler and Jimmy McHugh. We'll hear an arrangement by the tenor saxophonist Lauren Schoenberg. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Just picture me without you, and you without me. Just close your eyes and you'll see how lonely we'd be. Skies would fall, stars would all tumble. Life would be out of tune, dreams would soon crumble. There'd be no me without you, no you without me, and yet nobody could be as happy as we, smiling through, always together. I can't picture me without
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Museum of Modern Art in New York is paying tribute to screenwriter Frances Marion and the powerful women of early Hollywood. Coming up, we'll hear from Marion's biographer. Ian Whitcomb tells us about the band that played on the Titanic, and Ken Tucker reviews new CDs by two of Nashville's outsiders. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may be surprised to hear that one of the most powerful screenwriters in early Hollywood, the highest paid screenwriter for several years, was a woman. She wrote over 200 films, including the first Stella Dallas and Anna Christie. She won Oscars for The Champ and The Big House. She wrote hit films for her friend Mary Pickford, including Poor Little Rich Girl, Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm, and Pollyanna. But her name is not well known, which is something her biographer is trying to change. My guest Carrie Beecham's biography is called Without Lying Down, Frances Marion and the Powerful Women of Early Hollywood. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is now screening films by Marion and the Powerful Women of Early Hollywood. Beecham says that Frances Marion's success is in some ways not so surprising. Women wrote half of the Hollywood films produced before 1925. I asked Beecham why it was easier then for women to break into screenwriting.
Women, remember, in the teens and early 20s were also directors and producers. And I've come to conclude that the reason for that was that filmmaking was more collaborative, that women thrived in that collaborative setting. It wasn't filmmaking by committee because everybody did have their role. But it was collaborative. It was way before the time that we think of now as the auteur days of the director, of the great director, or of a single person putting their stamp on a film. These people truly did work together. One of the most joyous times for Frances was in 1917 when she was signed as the exclusive screenwriter for Mary Pickford. And she and Mary Pickford and their friend Mickey Nealon, who was the director, created half a dozen films in 2 years that set incredible box office records. And here I'm talking about Pollyanna and The Little Princess and films like that. But at the time, what's truly amazing to me is that Frances was 28, Mary was 25, and Mickey was 26.
And the medium was very young, too.
The medium was very young. That was another key for why women were allowed in, and not only allowed in, but then once they were in, were nurtured and flourished, was that very few people took the movie-making business seriously as a business. It was so quick, it was growing so quickly, and films would be an idea 1 week before the camera the next, in the theaters the next month. It was a very quick turnaround, and the Wall Street didn't really start to pay attention until the middle 20s.
You mentioned that Frances Marion wrote a lot of films for Mary Pickford, and Mary Pickford had this sweet, naive image on screen. Wasn't she called America's Sweetheart?
Yes.
But off screen, she was a real dynamo, from what I understand.
She was an incredible woman, truly incredible woman. And having seen all of her films now and, of course, reading all the scripts, I grew to have tremendous respect for her talent. She also was in many ways encaptured by this image. She would play roles like Pollyanna, the glad girl, the little sweetheart, and her fans would love it. And then she would try to stretch with a film like Stella Maris or The Love Light, where she played married woman falling in love with a German spy. And the fans did not like to see their little Mary in those type of roles. And so while she personally felt the desire to stretch and prove herself this great actress, she was forced time and time again, for commercial purposes, to return to the little girl role.
Did Frances
Marion? Eventually she suffered from that.
Did Frances Marion write a lot of those little girl roles for her, and did Frances Marion try to help her out of that image?
Frances wrote both. She wrote over half of all of Mary's films. And while they were such good friends, not that to think of them just as a writer and a star doesn't begin to say it, because they were, they lived next door to each other for a while. Then they lived within a block of each other. They would go to the studio together at 7 in the morning. At night, Frances would read to Mary while Mary had to spend an hour a night taking care of those golden curls, washing and setting them. They would figure out which film they were going to do next together. But more than that, Frances was there at the party in New York where Mary first met Douglas Fairbanks.
When Frances Marion started writing movies in the silent era, what did it mean to be a screenwriter in the days before dialogue?
Well, I was frankly surprised when I found scripts from as early as 1915 that were 60 pages in length. So what Frances would write would be the actions, the pantomimes, Frances prided herself in having a minimum number of titles needed, those sheets that where people would read what people were saying, because she felt strongly that if there was enough pantomime, you didn't need those explanations.
The transition to sound films was a crisis for a lot of silent film stars because suddenly they had to speak. People would hear their voices. What was the transition like for Frances Marion as a screenwriter? She had to write a different type of screenplay.
Well, in some ways, they had to make dialogue instead of titles, but they were freer in certain ways because it didn't have to fit on that little single card anymore. But film still had to move. Actions still had to be portrayed on the screen. And so for a while, studios went through, for 6 months to a year, they went through a minor crisis, bringing in dialogue coaches and Broadway stars who had practiced speaking. But it was really just a crisis much more for the actors and actresses than it was for the writers. And Frances made a relatively easy transition. In fact, Irving Thalberg at MGM gave her the assignment of writing Greta Garbo's first talkie, Anna Christie. And she also had the assignment of writing Norma Shearer's first two talkies. And Norma Shearer was not only the queen of the lot, but Irving Thalberg's wife. So that underscores the importance of Frances to MGM.
Do you have a favorite of Marion's screenplays?
I love Stella Dallas. I also adore her Scarlet Letter. I think some of the talkies are a lot of fun, but the silents are just gorgeous. Maybe one of my favorites, I think, is a film called Xander the Great, which she wrote for Marion Davies. And I think the reason that I like it so much is it opens with a scene of Marion in absolutely no makeup doing a bicycle routine worthy of Max Sennett. Very funny, very clever. It's the film of all of Marion Davies' films where I think her incredible natural comedic talents come through. And it shows what Marion Davies could have been as a talent if Hearst had let her.
William Randolph Hearst.
Right. And Hearst and William Randolph Hearst and Frances Marion worked together for 15 years off and on. Frances prided herself in working with different studios and different producers, not being tied to just one, although she did do most of her work with MGM. And Frances Marion and William Randolph Hearst had what I affectionately call a 15-year tug of war over the proper kind of roles for Marion Davies. Hearst always wanted her in massive costume epics where she played this glamorous woman. And Frances fought very hard to have her scrubbed down playing natural comedic roles, which she thought showed her talent off the best.
Marion Davies had a long time relationship with William Randolph Hearst, although he was officially married to somebody else, but he and Davies even lived together.
Right. He had five sons by Millicent Hearst and left them in New York from 1915 on, really, and lived with Marion Davies in California, and then, of course, built the San Simeon, the incredible castle that they lived in and ruled on for over 30 years until Hearst's death in, I guess, 1953.
My guest is Carrie Beacham, author of a new biography of Frances Marion. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Carrie Beacham, is the author of a new biography of Frances Marion, one of the most successful and prolific screenwriters in early Hollywood. When Frances Marion was the highest-paid screenwriter in Hollywood, how much was she making?
Well, she set the record originally in 1916 by being paid $200 a week, which at the time set all kinds of records. But very quickly thereafter, when she was signed in 1917 as Mary Pickford's exclusive screenwriter, she was paid $50,000 a year. 2 years later, Hearst hired her to write for Marion at $100,000 a year. So, I mean, even now, these are not small salaries. And you can imagine what that bought in 1919.
Why did Frances Marion earn so much? Did she have a style that was considered to be her specialty? Was she considered to have a golden touch?
She had a golden touch in a way, although she didn't really have to doctor other people's films. I mean, she always was looking at other films, but she wrote her own. What Frances, I think, made her film so special was she had a knack for creating characters that grabbed the audience very quickly. She gave her characters clever little quirks that endeared them to the audience. Her bad guys particularly always had a fun little something that endeared them. Wallace Berry in The Secret Six is a big gangster, but he always drinks milk. And the same with Wallace Berry in The Big House. She has a scene where he cries, and over his inability to read. I mean, these were, some would say, little, you know, feminine touches to these macho male characters that Frances excelled in. She also excelled in story structure. She loved writing the beginning and the end and then filling it in the middle. She loved the arc of the story, and which is one of the reasons her frustration grew in the early 30s when the production code started to mandate more and more regulations of what you could or could not do with your characters.
What ended her career?
Well, Irving Thalberg's death in 1936 was sort of the beginning of the end for Frances, in the sense that not that he protected her so much as, and she called him my Rock of Gibraltar, but that he respected her. He and respected Anita Loos and the other women writers that he worked with so well and encouraged. He, in fact, when Irving died, Frances was on a leave of absence in Europe, and I found a draft of a contract in her personnel file in MGM that said that when she returned in January of 37, she was to sign an exclusive contract to write, direct, and produce for Irving Thalberg for the next 5 years. Well, Irving died in September of 36, so that was, we're unable to know what would have happened. But we do know that when she came back in January, Louis B. Mayer changed her contract to a week-to-week agreement. And Frances had been spoiled. She was the first to admit it. She had worked wonderfully for years casting her films, working with these other actors, writing specifically for their talents, and working with them in a very collaborative way. And all of a sudden, she was on a week-to-week situation where she not only was to write her own scripts, but to be available to any director, any producer, to work on whatever screenplays they wanted doctored. And she found that very stultifying.
By the time Frances Marion retired from screenwriting in 1946, I think the door had closed for women in a lot of ways. I mean, this is a period when I think you're not seeing so many women writing screenplays or directing. What do you think are the factors that helped help close the door, if you agree that that's what happened?
I do agree that's what happened. I think it was a rather slow process, but I think it was not just in Hollywood. It was nationwide, and it happened to Rosie the Riveter. It happened to all the women who had come forward in World War II. And with the return of the soldiers, women returned home, and that was a very huge cultural, social phenomenon.
Yeah, but Frances Marion got started long before World War II. That's not what helped her in.
Of course she did.
Or other women.
No, but it helped wipe out women from the studios in so many ways that I have found in my conversations with women in Hollywood today where they have said, I thought I knew Hollywood history, and I thought women in Hollywood began in the 50s with Ida Lupino. Which is fascinating to me that, or they had a vague image of, yes, Mary Pickford also ran her own studio, but the women of Hollywood were for the most part thought to begin with Lupino in the late 50s because women were so wiped out, not just Frances and not just screenwriters, but the women in the publicity department and as assistant directors. They were, except for Dorothy Arzner, the one and only woman on the list of directors under contract in 1942.
What's it been like for you to see her movies with other people in a nice theater?
Oh, I tell you, it's for me, it's been the biggest thrill of this entire project. I mean, holding your own book in your hands is nice. Getting lovely reviews is nice. But walking in to Xander the Great a little late last week and seeing over 400 people laughing their heads off to Marion Davies was absolutely chilling to me. It was the biggest thrill I've had to know that these films are still drawing these kind of audiences. The Museum of Modern Art is very pleased with the incredible attendance they've had. It's a theater that holds 480 people. It's averaging over 400 a screening. And their plan is to show another 30 films in January and February that will mostly be the silent films written by Frances and her group of women friends.
Well, Carrie Beecham, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Carrie Beecham recorded last year. Her biography of Frances Marion is called Without Lying Down. The Museum of Modern Art's screen retrospective, Frances Marion and the Powerful Women in Early Hollywood, continues through February 17th. In the movie Titanic, the band's last song is Nearer My God to Thee. Well, that's the way the legend tells it. But Ian Whitcomb says it's not true. Whitcomb is an expert on early 20th century pop music. His new CD, Titanic, features some of the songs performed by the band on the Titanic with the same arrangements they used. We're going to hear the song he says was the last one played by the band, but first, let's talk to him about it. Ian, what makes you think that Dream of Autumn was actually the last song played on the Titanic as opposed to Nearer My God to Thee?
Well, I think common sense and facts. First of all, common sense. If you're playing in a band in a crisis, say a ship going down, or if you're on a plane, say, you wouldn't play something to scare people. Your whole job is to keep them calm. So common sense told me that, and then I looked up the facts. The facts are that the newspapers at the time, the New York Times, which I trust, carried an interview with Harold Bride, who was the Marconi operator at the time, and he was one of the last men off the ship. And he said quite categorically the last tune that they were playing was Autumn. We know that was shorthand for Song d'Automne. It wasn't the hymn. There is different tunes to that hymn. We know that he was referring to a current hit, Song d'Automne, by the English composer Archibald Joyce. Then on top of that, we have the actual testimony of the survivors who wrote books. Colonel Gracie said the same thing. And the list goes on, and it just makes sense. But of course, for the tabloids, it made melodramatic sense to say that it was Nearer My God to Thee.
Now, you think that the musicians were really the heroes of the Titanic. Tell me why.
Well, because they were altruistic in the true sense of the word. I mean, they weren't, as far as we know, they weren't ordered to go off and play. They volunteered to go off and play. And they were still in their suits, and they went into the lounge and assembled with their leader Wallace Hartley and began to play, and wisely played ragtime to cheer people up and to prevent panic. And then they moved up to the deck too, and they went on playing right, well, not till the end. I mean, sensibly they stopped about an hour before the ship finally went down, and then did their best to save themselves. Of course, they all perished, but I think they're the heroes of the ship.
Now tell us about the arrangement we're going to hear on Dream of Autumn.
This is the original arrangement played by the band on board the ship. It's what they call a stock arrangement, which was published and given free to musicians at that time. And I love this arrangement. It's a beautiful, beautiful song, and we have used exactly the same instruments. We haven't changed a note of this. And I think you'll agree it's a lovely song and a much better tune than Nearer My God to Thee.
Well, Ian Whitcomb, thank you very much, and let's hear from your recording, Titanic, music is heard on The Fateful Voyage. The last song on the CD, which you say is also the last song they played, Dream of Autumn. Music from Ian Whitcomb's new CD, Titanic, on Rhino Records. Coming up, new CDs by two Nashville outsiders. This is Fresh Air. Jim Lauderdale is a veteran country music songwriter who's written hits for acts like George Strait, Vince Gill, and Patti Loveless. His own albums, though, haven't sold well, and he's part of a group of musicians who are outsiders within Nashville, one of whom is Buddy Miller, who plays and writes on Lauderdale's new album called Whisper. Miller's most recent album, Poison Love, made rock critic Ken Tucker's year-end top 10 list. Here's Ken with reviews of both, starting with the title song from Jim Lauderdale's album.
I see you over there, smiling at the way I stare. I make a wish that you would be near enough to hear me when I whisper, whisper. I think of you. Whisper, whisper, I think I love you too.
The laconic, unadorned style of Jim Lauderdale's song Whisper summarizes why he's not a big star. He harks back to a simpler time in country music, when songs could build to their emotional effects and didn't have to commence with big, ear-grabbing hooks for bored country radio listeners. Buddy Miller, who plays guitar on most of Lauderdale's new album, takes the same sneaky approach on his own album, Poison Love.
Love in the ruins after the fall. What were we doing? Not thinking at all. I'll take the check for. To blame, someone just called me. Oh, was that just your name? But regret is a debt that I just can't pay. Cause there'd be more than I could ever make. Turn left when we get to that place in the road. Oh, we'll be on the one we shouldn't.
On Poison Love, Miller and his wife, the singer Judy Miller, collaborated on 100 Million Little Bombs, a song about the problem of unexploded landmines, not your usual country music subject. Yet in execution, it sounds like a classic lament.
$3 bomb, 100,000 road steps of a child.
Jim Lauderdale told Billboard magazine recently that he's sick of being labeled retro or alternative country, and that he wanted to cut, quote, just a classic country album. To this end, he's collaborated with a Nashville old-timer, Harland Howard, who's written country hits for half a century.
It's been hard to let you go. It's all part of life I know. Had enough holding on. It's time to sing that goodbye song. Well, I've been sitting here wasting time, hoping you might change your mind. Wishing for a love that's dead and gone. And I'm gonna sing that goodbye song.
Both Jim Lauderdale and Buddy Miller strike rock and roll ears like mine as guys who picked up riffs from the Beatles and the Byrds, as well as Buck Owens and George Jones. At this point, their alternative status may limit their commercial prospects, but the commercial situation of big-time country music is so precarious, with eroding audience shares and pointlessly overblown big stars like Leanne Rimes, that their outsider status is almost an enhancement. There's a freedom to working outside the mainstream that Buddy Miller, Judy Miller on her recent album Blue Pony, and now Jim Lauderdale on Whisper are taking full advantage of. Rock fans in search of melody and rhythm would do well to pay attention to them.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shorrock. Audrey Bentham is our engineer. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Gotta get up, gotta get going. Rain or shine, sleeting or snowing. Nothing can stop me, stop me, stop my loving you. I walk through the woods, climb a tall mountain. Loving's in my heart like water's in a fountain. Nothing can stop me, stop me, stop my loving you. Well, I crawl through a fire, walk through a river.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the return of thalidomide. It was banned in the 60s when it caused birth defects in babies born to women who took it while pregnant. Now the FDA may approve thalidomide to treat a number of diseases, including AIDS. Join us for the next Fresh Air.